This is Karen Brewster. Today is November 25th, 2025, and I'm here on Zoom with Carrie Brown, who is in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Steve Peterson, who is in Prescott Valley, Arizona, and I am in Fairbanks, Alaska. And this is an interview for the Iditarod National Historic Trail Project Jukebox. So thank you, gentlemen, for being with me this morning. I'm going to, just to get us started, I'll start with Carrie. I'll kind of go back and forth between you guys. If you can tell me a little bit about yourself before we get into your role with the trail, you know, sort of your background, where you came from, education, how you got to Alaska, that kind of stuff.
Well, I was born in Connecticut, but I moved when I was 4 to Texas, where I lived my adult life, most of my adult life. And I, let's see, how's this all go? I graduated in 61 from high school. And then I took a long time to get through college and had the Marines in between that time before I finally graduated, and I had got a degree in industrial engineering from Texas Tech, and then I got my MBA from Southern Methodist University with a concentration in strategic planning, and moved to, let's say, I worked as an engineer until I finished my master's, and then shortly thereafter I got a job offer in Alaska, working for BLM. After I got my MBA, I can't remember the sequence, but I was looking for a job in Alaska, and I'd interviewed when I'd gotten my bachelor's degree from Bechtel Corporation that offered me a job in Alaska, but it was working for the Alaska, but I had to live in San Francisco, and that wasn't part of my plan. So when I got my MBA, I kind of applied to the federal government and got a job with the Bureau of Land Management Outer Continental Shelf Office, which is now no more. Let's see, hang on a second. That is now no more. And I worked for them for about 2.5 years. Then I applied for a job with the main part of BLM as the program leader for outdoor recreation and wilderness for all the BLM land in Alaska. And I got that job. I got to Alaska in 74, and I got that job. Well, that's when I got the job. That's when I got the BLM, first BLM job. The second job was about 76, I think. That's probably when I met you, Steve, somewhere along that.
Yeah.
And so I got that job, and I worked in that. My boss was the chief of resources at the state office, working for the state director. So I didn't manage the outdoor recreation program, but I was a project leader, and that meant I distributed the money to all the different programs through BLM programs throughout Alaska. I had a big say so in it anyway. So in the late 70s, my boss, I'm trying to kind of recollection. My boss asked me to take over. Iditarod project had been assigned shortly before as a National Historic Trail and designated BLM to write the management plan. My boss asked me if I'd like to change offices and change jobs and become the project leader for the Iditarod National Historic Plan, National Historic Planning Effort, National Historic Trail Planning Effort. And after some negotiation, I wanted to go out as a branch chief if I was going to move to the Anchorage District Office out of the state office. I wanted to go as a branch chief, and they made me a branch chief of outdoor recreation and wilderness and cultural resources. And I lasted in that job for a short amount of time. Then I figured out the Iditarod was going to be a full-time job. And because I had employees like Steve that was not cooperating, you know. And so so I had to find out, I had to find other people that were just like Steve. So that was about 79. Then I went out to the Anchorage District Office and took this new job. That's better.
Okay. Great. Thank you. And now, Steve, your sort of similar background.
Well, I was born in Storm Lake, Iowa, and I grew up in that area, Northwest Iowa, until, I went off to school in Minnesota, at Mankato State College, and graduated with a degree in art. And it was during the age of the Vietnam War and the draft, and so I was drafted on a Wednesday, and I graduated on a Friday, and a week and a half later, I was in the Army. A short turnaround there. They didn't waste any time in those days.
No.
And ended up going through training in the infantry, and we were basically, we'd received our hard orders for Vietnam in the very first cutbacks. Basically, it was spearheaded by Mike Gravel, if you will. His filibuster on the Senate floor, he argued that there were too many people in an undeclared war zone, and so they started the very first cutbacks in Vietnam. And I was queued up to leave, and I was one of the very first cutbacks, and they sent us off, a bunch of us, to Alaska, Panama, and Germany. I got Alaska on the draw and ended up at Fort Wainwright in 1971, I guess, where I filled out my time and discharged out of Fairbanks. And I had, we had lived in by then I was married, and we had lived in Fairbanks, and Judy had come to Fairbanks in October of that year, and I saw how great the summers were up there. So I looked around and applied for some jobs in the state, and I was hired by BLM as a fire administrative assistant service chief out of Tanacross by Tolk. And we went down there for the summer and were dazzled by the interior summers, if you will. It lasted there till the fall. We moved to the lower 48 in the fall, thinking we were going to go back to where I had grown up in Spencer, Iowa by that time. We lasted a little over a year and a half and decided that was a big mistake. And we turned around and packed up and moved back to Alaska to Tolk, where I resumed my previous summer or two summers job as an admin assistant. And after about a year and a half, BLM received a line item appropriations from Senator Stevens to restore the old military fort at Fort Egbert in Eagle, Alaska. And since BLM had nobody capable of doing work like that, and my head was barely above water in the capability thing, I all of a sudden was a project manager for putting that back together. So I spent 5 years in Eagle and Tolk restoring Fort Egbert. At the end of that period, I decided that I wanted to go back to architecture school, and I applied to the University of Oregon, the graduate program, and was accepted. And that began basically a three-year academic year involvement at the University of Oregon. And my summer job was working with Kerry on the Iditarod Trail. So we would come north in the summer, and I'd worked on that, doing the inventory, and stayed with that until the project's completion. And then I went into private practice in Anchorage with a firm that's no longer there, but had been there since Second World War, CCC Architects, Architecture in Anchorage. And with their demise, post-pipeline depression, a job opened with the National Park Service in Anchorage. And so I applied and was accepted as the regional historical architect for the Alaska region of the Park Service, and spent the rest of my career guiding, overseeing the restoration projects in most of the national parks up there, culminating in my retirement in last day of 2012, with the primary responsibility for putting the Kennecott mine site back together. I spent about 15 years working with the park and park staff and being the architect for putting it back together.
All right, great, thank you. Yes, I know of your name, have never met you before, but I know of your name for the Park Service historic architect
work. Yeah, I didn't mention it, but deja vu on oral history. I oversaw several oral history projects in the 40-mile resource area. And I think there were some of the very first tapes in your collection up there. That would have been in, 72, 73? I think we had several interns over two or three summers interviewing the old pioneers from the 40-mile area. It's
great.
It's in your collection there.
Right, great. So on the Iditarod Trail, so Carrie, you were the team leader, project leader for the comprehensive plan, is that?
That's correct, yep.
So what did that entail?
Well, it entailed hiring a staff, which I did, and kind of one at a time people got interest in it, and they... I'm not sure if they talked to Steve. Steve, I think, was the first one. And then we had Terry O'Sullivan and several other people that are, Bob Spooty, some other people that we recruited on a full-time basis to work with this office, which was based at the Anchorage District office. And the first thing we did as a group, the group kept coming and going, but most of them were permanent to the project till I left in 81. We'd just informally, formally, informally, sometimes we'd go out to breakfast and talk about like goals and objectives, trying to figure out what the legislation said, number one, and how we're going to fulfill the directions that the legislation would have us do. And I don't think we had an advisory council until later in the project, but that was part of it, is finding the people that were interested and could be a contribution to the project with their history and their expertise. So
how did you find people like Steve and Bob Spooty and Terry?
Well,
and
BLM in Alaska, staff-wise, is pretty small. And some of these people worked for HCRS and came up with the Bureau of Outdoor Recreation and changed agencies and whatnot. And, it's a small group of Interior Department people that worked in Alaska, and they were all in resource management for some way or cultural resource management in some way or another. And I'm not sure, Steve, maybe you can help me on this, but I'm not sure if we recruited them or they expressed an interest or they needed a place that was that we had funding. We had a line out of appropriation to work on the Iditarod project, and maybe some of these other people, I don't recall, they were looking for somebody to fund their positions, when I was glad to do that because of their expertise. And so the primary thing that we started on are figuring out what our goal was. And then the next thing was figuring out the objectives, how we're going to reach these goals. And most of that was, a lot of that was outlined in the enabling legislation, what they wanted to see. And we took that as a start, and then kind of we kind of added our two cents worth. And then we got the staff together to figure out exactly what we have to do for this designated trail that was in the legislation, and expand upon it to find out who can do what. You know, I was active, but all the other guys, like Steve, was always gone. He was out, you know, he had his own helicopter, as I recall. But he was always gone, and I'd always look for him, and he'd be gone, you know.
Day. Well, you know, interoffice politics and all, you know.
Yeah. So we had individuals like Bob Spooty and Steve and Terry O'Sullivan that had individual responsibilities, and we'd kind of work out who would do what because of their, you know, their expertise. And we'd find where we had gaps. Like we had a gap in BLM did not have any interpretive specialists at all. And part of the plan was to have an interpretive, you know, exhibits and interpretive program. And so we recruited Gene Swearingen, who worked for the National Park Service at the time, just as a kind of an ad hoc person to help us with that part of it. But she wasn't working for me full time. She wasn't working for me at all. She was just alone. And people like Spooty, I think he didn't change agencies. Who was he working for, Steve?
Well, he was with HCRS. And I think they were involved in it early on with Pat for show.
Well, absolutely.
When the designation was winding its way through Congress, if you will. And so that it got at a point, I don't know when it was handed off to BLM, but Bob acted as kind of a liaison because of his, well, he's an historian, first of all, and he had a lot of interest in it, a lot of experience backcountry Alaska. He's retired now in Santa Fe.
Yeah. What is HCRS?
Heritage Conservation and Recreation Service. It was an agency that was created, I believe, under Jimmy Carter. And it never really found its legs. I think it probably existed for 4 or 5 years, and then their responsibilities were integrated back into the Interior Department and Park Service and BLM and other agencies.
So it was an agency within the Interior Department?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you had mentioned Pat Porchot, and I had wanted to ask you guys if, you know, you knew anything about or were involved in that, you know, the trail getting designated. Carrie, you had mentioned at some point when I talked to you on the phone, Pat Porchot and Senator Gravel's office, their role in getting it designated. So,
well, Pat Porchot worked for HCRS. He came up with HCRS, and then he got recruited by Gravel's office. And somewhere in between, there was a book written on Alaska Gold Rush trails, and one of the Gold Rush trails was the Iditarod. I can't remember what the other ones were, but I think for some way that book might have been written by HCRS or Pat had a role.
I think it was. Yeah.
Well, there was the Bureau of Outdoor Recreation.
Well, that
and that's who Pat worked for. That's what he, and that's that report I think you're talking about.
Well, it could have been. It wouldn't. Maybe it wasn't HCRS because those two agencies kind of they were there just a short time, and then they all melded into, like Steve said, into the Park Service or into BLM. And so Pat, I guess he did work for BOR.
And one was Outdoor Recreation and the other was Cultural Resources. And they broke the resource responsibilities basically between those two agencies way back.
Okay.
So anyways, Pat got recruited into Gravel's office, and he's the one that got this all rolling. I mean, he's the one that drafted the legislation, and he's the one that chose BLM, bless his heart, to write the project plan and kind of do the management of the trail. That was the intent, anyways. And so Pat and I were kind of friends, and I think he was in the group, and I think Steve was in that group too. That we knew Pat, and he was an impressive guy, and he's the one that ramrodded this whole thing through Congress. And he's the one that got us specific line item appropriation so nobody else would screw with our money, which is another story. But he was the motivating person, and I think he had a lot to do with the actual wording of the legislation.
I did do an interview with him, so he is in the jukebox talking about his role, but I want to hear your guys' perspective on how all that happened and if you were around and what you knew about it.
Well, if it wasn't for Pat, there wouldn't be due to our national short trip, in my opinion. Steve, what do you think?
Yeah, I think definitely. He eyes and ears for Alaskan issues. And I think it all coincided, if I'm not mistaken, with like the first designation of the Oregon Trail and some of those. And I think it did it become a rider to the, whatever that legislation was, and he I think he amended it or kept it in the focus of
I know that there were other recreation trails, and then there was sort of the early historic trails. I think you're right, the Oregon Trail, and I did a rod kind of got added in.
Yeah, and Mormon Trail, was it Mormon Trail too? There were several of them.
I don't remember.
Yep. So one of the first things I did is trying to figure out what the hell a National Historic Trail was. And I would, I went to different places in the United States, mainly spending time at the Appalachian Trail headquarters in Harpers Ferry. Trying to find out how this wasn't a historic trail, but it was a recreational trail, and how they were managing that trail, because it went through so many jurisdictions and so many land ownerships, and that turned out to be kind of the basis of where we thought we wanted to go on the Iditarod. It was managed by volunteers, and because the Iditarod, like the Appalachian Trail, went through various ownerships, private, public, different public agencies, state, native lands. And so we could see that we weren't going to go out and buy any lands, and it wasn't going to, it's going to be in multiple jurisdictions. And so there was such a link between how they were managing the Appalachian Trail and how the emphasis was on our plan to do the same.
Do you remember any of the other trails you looked at besides the Appalachian?
Well, I'm getting mixed up, because after I finished that project with the Iditarod, I was on another project to have a road that was designated in the enabling legislation. And I visited other people for that purpose. I'm kind of getting a little mixed up, but I think there was an ice road or something in the Midwest that was I just don't remember.
Yeah, that's okay.
Steve, did the Oregon Trail, that designation, did that exist before the Iditarod?
I think it was part of the same enabling legislation.
Yeah.
If I remember, actually had never seen the legislation, but I just remember us talking about it from 45 years ago.
Do you know why BLM was chosen as the manager instead of, the Park Service?
Well, I think that had to do with Pat. I mean, he had a lot of friends with I don't know if he had many friends with the Park Service, but he had a lot with BLM because of the connection between BOR, HCRS, and BLM. Park Service was a little different. They weren't really into the, they were getting created in Alaska, but remember they were just designated in 78 and finally in 1980 after the
Anilka.
Yeah.
Well, I think no small part was thinking back to that period of time of the Anilka and D2 and all the land upheaval, you know, before all of that was settled out. The Park Service was not exactly the favored agency in the state of Alaska. And I think you kind of hit on the fact that multiple ownerships, volunteerism, that BLM really, that's the arena they'd operated in for so many years up there. I mean, the BLM land was everywhere. And so I think it was probably, you know, thinking about the political fever that was going on, anti-Park Service at that age at BLM seemed to be the most appropriate fit. I think that if it had been designated as a Park Service effort, you'd have had the wrath of the delegation and the Alaskan people down on you. It's totally changed these days, but thinking back that period of time, it was rough going, I think, for the Park Service. So I think it was just expedience.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. You're right. Before Anilka, BLM was the major federal land manager.
And they were, yeah.
So that makes sense. Steve, we talk a little bit about your role at the beginning. You said in the summers you worked on an inventory or something?
Back to the helicopter.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about when something like a National Historic Trail is created, Congress creates it, and then they ask the managing agency to define it. What is it? Where is it? And that's where I came in. My primary responsibility, I think, was building the kind of the first atlas of the trail route, trail corridor. And we did that through several things, a lot of field work, riding around in Kerry's helicopter, popping into villages and mining camps and talking with the local people, who a lot of them had generations of residency in those areas and had a really good understanding of where the old trails came in and where it came out. We used some of the documents that really define the trail. One was, you know, we determined that the Alaska Railroad at the time of the Iditarod event had gone as far as, well, it was halfway up Cook Inlet there, and that the trail took off to Aklutna. The military had surveyed all the way to Rainy Pass, and they may have gone beyond that. So there was actually drawings and such that the Alaska Railroad in Anchorage has a wonderful collection of antique maps and historic documents defining the trail. We found information in the territorial governor's report that documented it was an annual report to Congress from the territorial days, and there's just a wealth of infrastructure like information in there, and that identified a lot of the roadhouses and shelter cabins, relief cabins that were constructed by the old territorial government, and that they were created and spotted on trail segments. The Iditarod was never a one-time, let's start in Seward and go to Nome kind of thing. It was a patchwork of village trails, native trails, access routes. And the trail was pretty much defined when in the atlas that we put together, as places where the trail tread was still obvious, and physically on the land you could see the trail, and there was, you know, you look around from a helicopter perspective, there were no other routes. A lot of the trail, you realize it was a winter trail. So it was very much terrain dependent. So you tended to follow stream beds in a lot of cases where there basically was no trail tread. But topography really, really defined the route itself. And then interviews with people that lived along and had a long history with the trail. I drank a lot of coffee and ate a lot of homemade donuts that summer, talking to people in the different mining camps, the Miskoviches and Flat and Poorman and, you know, Edgar Callan. And I mean, there were a lot of people like that that had good insight into where the trail was on a very local or regional basis. So anyway, we came up with an atlas that defined primary route, secondary routes, the type of trail, terrain dependent, a stream bed, a defined trail. And we also spent a lot of time going into the different, a lot of them were ruins, but a lot of them were structures that remained, like the Dexter Trading Post in Gullivan, and you know, there were lots of places like that that were still standing at that time. So it just, it was putting together a patchwork of a lot of different pieces that we were able to define the route, and that's what was submitted in our comprehensive plan, was that atlas.
Also, in the plan, they referred to the 1916 Alaska Route Commission map that was in there, and I think that was the basis, one of the bases, and Steve can help me on this, of having to start somewhere to identify the trail, you know, because Steve says it was not one trail, it was a bunch of routes going from the, you know, the Goldfield fell from the ice-free port of Seward to the Goldfield of Nome.
And then there was the stretch from Nikolai to Rainy Pass, you know, the Farewell Burn. That was surveyed. George L. Goodwin?
Well, Goodwin was his last name.
Yeah, he was a surveyor, and he ran the trail with a dog sled with a, what do you call it, not a speedometer, but an odometer on it. That basically gave distance and place, and he laid out and surveyed the Farewell Burn area. So by putting all those little pieces together and then connecting the dots of roadhouses and such, the trail, primary trail route during that historic period of time became fairly obvious.
And you have to remember, during this time, 45 years ago, there were still a lot of living people that had actually gone back to the early 1900s that had used the trail, their families used the trail, and it was essentially the winter highway between villages, and between, it was a main route in the wintertime.
And Tom Beck's oral history project kind of grew out of that realization, I think, as we were out along the trail, you found out about people that were informants and, you know, they warranted a closer look in the interview, and some of those tapes should be in your collection there, Karen.
Yeah, they are. They're also available online through Arliss.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Hmm. But thank you. I had wondered how that project Tom Beck did came about, so you answered that question.
Well, I think, you know, it became obvious that certain people knew a lot about it, and it was, and they were going quickly, and you know, we did the oral history in the 40 mile, and it just seemed like a no-brainer to try to capture what we could with some of the true statesmen of the route, if you will.
Right.
Well, and we were blessed by funding too.
Yeah,
you know, we could recruit people that their organization was probably glad to have them assigned to the Iditarod project because they wouldn't be on their budget. And okay. And it's not denigrating them as much as it was like we get the pick of the litter on people that we wanted to work on the Iditarod project in those categories that we really needed. Now we got Terry O'Sullivan and a lot of these people that were, and Steve, you know, and a lot of these people that were perfect. And Steve was, like, at the time, he was going back and forth between Oregon and Anchorage.
Mm-hmm. So those people who they worked with you on the comprehensive plan, but they still had their jobs with their agencies, but they got paid by you guys?
I can't remember how that worked. I some of them were just working with us, and they didn't change allegiances, but there's some of them were people that actually worked for us on WEE, is that what they called it?
Yeah, when actually employed.
Yeah, right, on a part-time basis, just when we needed them.
And that's what I was on, yeah, because I was going to grad school.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Total boondoggle, but we did it anyways.
Thank you very much for that, Kerry.
Before, one little side question that for Steve is about the historic structures. You mentioned the trading post and some of those old roadhouses and cabins, that there were actually still some there. And as a historic architect, did you do anything to document those or
what? Yeah, there were a lot of ruins, but in some cases, the relief cabins and shelter cabins had continued to be used just for those purposes. We tried to document them based on the historic period of the Iditarod. I mean, the Episcopal Church in Nome with its spire, that was a visual landmark at the end of the trail. The Dexter Trading Post had operated prior to the Iditarod and it was supported the trail. Old Woman Cabin site on the Kel-Tag Portage, the Ruby Roadhouse. There were a lot of Iditarod. The old town of Iditarod still had some ruins or some buildings that were existing. Dykeman, the town of Dykeman, had a front street, if you will, with several false front commercial buildings. Flat, the whole town of Flat was still there. I don't know, about the only ones I know of that have been taken care of was the Episcopal Church in Nome was restored some years ago or adaptively reused by the community, relocated and rehabilitated. A lot of log cabins. A lot of when the Road Commission eventually got involved in it, or the territorial government, if I remember correctly, the territorial governor's report listed for, I can't remember, a year, 2 years, 3 years, some of the relief cabins that were, or shelter cabins, to use the term interchangeably, were paid for and constructed by what was, can't remember if it was called the Road Commission pre-state days or not, but anyway, it would document how many were built and how much it had cost, and they even had who did it. They were all very humble, you know, they weren't great other than like the Episcopal Church, you know, they were not architectural gems, they were very first generation, vernacular landscapes, you know, built with local material, log, a lot of log. The territorial governor's buildings were basically plywood, early day plywood and wood framing. In fact, some of them were built like in Nome and then skidded out or slitted out and put in place. So there was a whole variety of different vernacular buildings on the trail.
And what about the southern part from Seward to Aklutnan?
Yeah, that was, well, there was, let me think here. most, of course, there was the old depot in Seward, mm-hmm. which was a point of entry, you know, and a reception, if you will, for people coming on the train. Along the, Sunrise, Hope, we interviewed people in those locations. Some of the trails kind of had little spurs to them. But the railroad ran all the way, I can't remember the name of it. It had the, it's halfway between Girdwood and Portage. There was the end of the route at that period of time. And the rest of it was being surveyed and construction was going on all the way to Occlutna. And there were different routes that had been proposed to do that. Anchorage didn't exist more or less at that point, you know. I think a couple ship,
right.
a couple old Forest Service employees on the point there. I think that was about the limit of the city's
footprint. Well, the trail went over through Crow Pass,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And down into Occlutna. Yeah.
Yeah. But there weren't any old roadhouses or cabins or anything on that.
No, not that I recall.
Okay.
When you got to Kinnick, I mean, on the other side of the Kinnick Arm, the old commercial street was there, a few commercial buildings, and then that was the jumping off point going towards Rainier Pass. Mm-hmm. Occlutna, I think that, I'm not even certain that the Orthodox Church here at Occlutna, there's an old church here that probably was from that day. I can't remember its association.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Well, it's interesting that there were still, you know, in the late 70s when you were doing this, there actually were still some structures that you could document.
Yeah, I basically did drawings of most of them, sketches, and BLM should have them there someplace in their gaggle of information. I don't know. I have no idea where that information went. The one resource that I still is, and I mentioned it earlier, that's exciting is the old railroad mapping and surveys. They had quite an inventory there, and I don't know if it's still being held in Anchorage or got transferred. It should be in a museum someplace.
Well, it should be in an archive. Yeah, it's
exactly.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if the railroad keeps an archive of things. It's an interesting question.
They had a well-organized archive when we went through. Ted Trueblood, I believe, was the engineer in charge of engineering, if you will. Yeah, they had some very, very beautiful drawings that were hand-inked and colored, and they were pretty amazing.
Wow. That's
Steve, cool. Did you work with the SHPO on some of this stuff?
Not really.
Yeah.
They knew it was going on. I think Spoodie probably. If anybody interacted with the SHPO, it was Bob.
Yeah.
At that point.
Didn't you have somebody
Didn't
you have somebody going with you when you went into some of these villages? I mean, some of these ruins that was associated with drawings or something that would get documented. I can't remember. There was a guy that I thought accompanied you some, and he was the one that was submitting the certain sketches to a national.
Oh, that Historic American Building Survey, Habs drawings.
Right, the Habs drawings.
Yeah. And did we bring Jet Low, the Habs photographer?
I don't know.
On the Iditarod?
The name is Bill. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember. We did, didn't we? We did.
Yeah.
We did drawings of some of the sites. You'd have to. It's in the National Archives. They have an inventory, and if there are any drawings, they should be available there. Usually, there's a couple different. Like level one documentation is drawings, precise drawings and photographs. And level two is just photographs that the National Archives possesses. And we did a bunch of that over the years in Alaska for all over the state. So,
right. But it's interesting that I've heard of Habs, but that you had somebody along with you initially for the Iditarod Trail.
I can't remember. It was incidental. It's like the second year. Randy Skyrick. I brought him up as an intern. He later went to work on the Iditarod. Well, for that one summer, he may have done Dexter. I can't remember. And there was another cabin site, between Mountain Village and Gullivan. I can't remember what specifically he may have done. Randy went on to work. He's probably retired from the Park Service. He was in the Denver Service Center. He went on to go to work with them. At that time, though, he was just an intern, summer job, I think, for him. Boy, there's a lot of cobwebs over that one.
you think you got them.
So let's move into the actual comprehensive management plan and what that entailed and how you got that all implemented. So that's, we'll start with Carrie, because you were sort of in charge of that, right?
Yeah, we kind of started from scratch, but like I'd mentioned before, a lot of what we needed to know was in the enabling legislation to give us the initial guidance. But then we had to, while we had those up on a flip chart or whatever, we had to narrow it down to a specific goal. And I think that's in the draft management plan and also the objectives which were necessary to implement the goal. And I think those are also in the plan. So, you know, I was probably cranked up for a few months in the office because I was working on that other part of my job as the branch chief out there, and then trying to do the Iditarod, format for the Iditarod plan and who I was going to need to help me. And then I got to it full time, I guess that was in 79, and started hiring staff. And I'd get people like Steve. I think Steve will be one of the first on board to say what we needed, because I didn't have any expertise in everything, in anything. Still don't. But yeah. I'd use people with resources like and expertise like Steve and Bob Spooty and architectural people. Historians and archaeologists that would work on an as-needed basis.
And Terry O'Sullivan.
Yeah, Terry. Yeah. And Terry was a planner, you know, and he was my right hand. He and Steve were the right hand guys, you know.
Yeah, I was say, how do you know what to put in the plan? I mean, you said, so what were your goals and objectives?
I have to read the plan. I have to read the plan.
Okay.
I've got it around here somewhere. In fact, I just pulled it out this morning. It blew the cobwebs off of it. You know, it was a remarkably good draft management plan in many ways. And I look back on that part with, I think we all do, with pride on that it was so thorough and well documented. I mean, all the stuff that Steve did was in, well, not all the stuff, but a lot of the stuff on priorities and recommendations for protection and stabilization. And the thing that got us in trouble is trying to figure out how to implement this by funding. And that's what got me in trouble. So it was just, once we established the goals and the objectives, which were in the plan and pretty much followed the enabling legislation, then we expanded to see what resources, what we had to do to meet those objectives. And a lot of it involved inventory, like Steve was doing. I mean, Steve was gone all the time, and most of the guys were gone all the time. Nobody hung out at the office except me, and I was just answering the phone, you know. And so it was such a collaborative effort. I may have been the team leader, but I had all these people that knew what their job was, and they were going out trying to bring in. When we'd get the information back, we'd synthesize it and try to figure out what was germane and what we didn't need. And because you could spend, you know, your whole career doing chasing these rabbit trails. And so we had to narrow those down and figure out what was cogent and what wasn't. The structure for the plan, if you read the plan, as I tried to look at this morning, which I hadn't seen in 40 years, but we were trying to do projects that meet the objectives. The inventory and the roadhouses, the oral histories. You know, we had Tom Beck doing the oral histories, and then Steve doing the architectural stuff and the historical architectural stuff. And then Terry was putting, I can't remember what his specific job, but he was, right there with me trying to organize it all.
So Carrie, part of your job was to keep everybody kind of focused.
Yeah.
You said they'd go off on all these rabbit trails and things.
They would. Like somebody wanted to do the fisheries and what the impact was on fisheries. That wasn't necessary, you know. So we kind of limited. That was a person right there at the office, the Anchorage office, who was really trying to butt in. And I finally just, with my very subtle style, told her to butt off, you know. And so we had to focus on what was really necessary to meet the goals and objectives. And that was my job. It was Steve's job. It was everybody's job, because I wouldn't think of all these things myself. And we'd work as a group. I mean, really collaboratively. I mean, we'd get together and figure it out. But everybody's gone so much of the time. It was only, you know, once a week or so we'd all get together.
Carrie, I think you may have been in the office, but it was a new kind of effort by us, but it was really new to management of BLM. I think you probably did more to write interference between the agency and their questioning or not understanding just what a National Historic Trail was. I think that BLM was very naive about its cultural resource responsibilities, and I think there was a lot of second guessing, and we were making it up as we went along, and they were making it up even more. there was a vacuum there, I think.
Well, and we were reporting to two different bosses.
Yeah.
Number of different bosses, but you know, we did a lot of public meetings. We went to villages where we had ongoing dialogue with the advisory committee, and mm-hmm. we had certain key players that were very instrumental. What was the guy's name from Seward that was the volunteer coordinator?
Dan Seavey.
Dan Seavey.
He just died recently.
Yeah.
And people like that really had an interest in what was going to go on with that trail, and they led a lot of the volunteer efforts. But, you know, we're picking people's brain, trying to figure out who knew what. And the advisory committee was great. Joe Reddington was great, and some of them, and Libby Riddles. And
Dick Mackey was on there, too, wasn't he?
He and Rod Perry, you know?
Yeah. Dick was his father was a key player in the Appalachian Trail, wasn't he?
Oh, was he? Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. So he was.
Well, I know Dick. Yeah, Dick was from New Hampshire. I also interviewed Dick, he's in the jukebox. Yeah. And Dan, and also Lee Pileski from Seward, also.
Who was
Rod Perry would know. I mean, he'd be a good contact. He was married to Patty Friend, and. They both run the Iditarod, and so they were a wealth of information because they had a vested interest in it, aside from just, you know, being a part of my resources to talk to.
Yeah.
But they really wanted this thing to work.
Yeah.
we had had numerous public meetings that all, I'm sure they're all in the plan, it's the draft plan itself, and who we talked to, and unfortunately, I should have taken the plan out. I was looking at it and said, God, this is a good, pretty good plan, you know, that we did. And I think we thought it was the same at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, what was the response in the villages when you came through and said, well, this is a historic trail now, this is what we're planning?
Well, it depends. Some people really supported it because that was part of their heritage. But some people didn't want the intrusion. They were thinking that we were going to open up the trail for snow machines. Well, as it turns out, we did, but we didn't mean to do that. And they didn't want the intrusion into their life, the village life. But most of them were very supportive because it was part of their history, and it was a proud part of the history.
Yeah, yeah. I found that in the communities I went into, you know, you come flopping in a helicopter, people are, especially in that period of time in Alaska politically on the lands rights issues, the minute they found out you was working on the Iditarod Trail, they just opened arms. Like I said, ate more donuts and drank more coffee that summer, or two summers.
Right.
I have since. So, yeah, no,
it was very receptive. Like Steve said, and it was the part. I mean, the diphtheria run. What year was that? I mean, that was still in their history.
Yeah. At least
for them.
Right, the Nome Serum run. What was that? 25.
I can't remember. Boy.
Yeah,
1925, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
Well, and also the Iditarod sled dog race had already started in 73, right? So people were already coming through those villages.
That's right.
And the villages embraced it. I mean, they loved it. So.
That's right. They'd be sitting there and, you know, helping people feed the dogs, and still to this day, I think it's quite an event, more of an event than probably some of the villages like. But historically, when, you know, I think Joe Reddington and what was his wife's name,
Vi,
you know, and they were the first, and if it wasn't for them and the impetus that they had, who knows what would have happened? It's just been a trail in history.
Right. Well, and there's, for a lot of Alaskans, when you say Iditarod Trail, they think of the race. They don't realize that it's a designated historic trail before that. I mean, I didn't before I started working on this project. So is that something you guys have had to deal with?
Well, yes. I mean, the way it ended up, it should have been so much more on the, not on the local level, but the national level, on this very historic trail with an interpretive center, like the Oregon Trail, you know, like its own staff and coordinators and people that could spend time trying to implement what we thought in the draft management plan. But that would have taken staff, and that would have taken money. And those were our recommendations. I think we had levels on there, didn't we, Steve?
What's that?
Didn't we have levels like on priorities, different levels?
Gosh. Yeah, I can't remember. I can't remember what we had.
I do know that there were recommendations for interpretive exhibits and, as you say, visitor center and things like that 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 never happened, and I'm wondering, why did that not ever happen?
Because BLM was managing it, and they didn't want a commitment on having to pay for these things that we were recommending. I think if it had been Park Service, it would have been totally different. You know, I refer to the Oregon Trail, you know, Oregon National Historic Trail. Yeah. It just, they didn't want to make the commitment to divert resources, in my view, divert resources to commit on a implementation plan for the Iditarod.
An active management plan. Yeah.
And is that something you tried to make happen, Carrie?
Oh, I did, and that's why I got fired, you know.
Oh, I don't know that, so go ahead.
Well, I don't know where to go back. But anyways, we started having conflicts with the state office people that were working for the state office, and the staff that I work for. I think I told you this, my boss was the district manager, and he was very supportive of all of us doing our thing. And the state office staff was supposed to be for kind of overview and consultation, but they didn't really have any line item authority over me or in my staff. But they took that personally, and when we didn't do what they wanted, they would, I'm not sure there would be a hindrance, but it would be kind of competitiveness, I think, on strategy. I mean, a good example was, I'd mentioned Gene Swearingen. They didn't have anybody, and they were criticizing the recommendations because they, you know, BLM doesn't do that. We don't do interpretation. They didn't at that time. So to continue the story, when we finished the plan, 1981, I'd had a great slideshow put together by Tom. What's his name? You remember his last name? That did the
Beck?
One of the guys that would long ponytail, worked in the district office, really cool guy.
Yeah, I don't.
Yeah. Anyways, he put this great slideshow together, and I had a presentation and appointments in Washington, D.C., with not only staff on BLM staff back there, but also on Senator Stevens, Senator Gravel's office, whoever else was over there that I could talk to, with a presentation. The plan for the presentation, not only the slideshow, but reviewing the plan that I had copies of. But the problem with the plan is that the state office wanted to say, we don't want anything mentioned in there about budget. We don't want to mention about budget or priorities, you know. And because they didn't want to be committed, in my opinion, they didn't want to be committed to that kind of funding request that might interfere with other operations, which is understandable. But my boss was very supportive, and he said, just go for it. Well, I had somebody on the other side said, don't go for it. Do not go. My direct order is, you do not go. And my boss, who didn't like the other boss, said, go for it. So I went. I no sooner landed, got to the Interior Department, BLM officers, and I had a phone call waiting for me from the state director, who was the boss of both of those guys. And he said, well, I have to work out these personnel differences at back home, and I'll deal with that, but I don't want you going to the senator's or the congressman's offices. So that was all cut short. The big presentation that would informally not ask for money, but show them what they needed to implement the recommendations in the draft management plan. And so I no sooner got back, and my boss, Dick, what's his name? Who was the boss in the old days?
Dick Werman? Kurt McPhee?
The manager of the district office.
District. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I can see the face. I can't remember his name.
And he quit. I mean, he retired. And then a guy named Dick Werman came in, took his job, and Dick and I did not get along at all. And as a matter of fact, we didn't get along forever until we became very good friends after he retired. You know, it's kind of a strange thing. But anyways, he's the one that implemented me changing jobs. I consider that being fired. And I went on to another congressionally designated program that didn't last very long. But then they turned it over to Terry, and Terry took on this. I've never seen the final plan. I've only got the draft plan, so I haven't even seen the final plan. I don't know what it said, but I was not a part of it anymore. And I'm sure it came from the opposition from the state office that I wasn't willing to bend as much as they wanted, which is kind of a issue that I'd probably need to deal with directly in my whole life. But, you know, the result was is that the draft plan was done. The final plan, it was, you know, out of my hands, and I don't know what happened after that. And that was 1981, I think, 82, 81.
Yeah.
The thing that was amazing about that whole effort to me was that I think we all felt on the team that BLM had a real white hat project here, a real opportunity to really do the public good in the context of all of the political turmoil that was going on over all the land's rights. And they dropped the ball. They couldn't see the potential of what they had and didn't embrace it. Selective neglect.
Well, you know, looking back on it, you know, you kind of do a little introspection as I could have been a little bit more political, and I could have kind of seen where this was going in terms of one boss working against the other boss. And I could have intervened probably in a more compatible way. And
I don't know.
I was pretty resentful of them coming in and telling us we like what you've done, but we don't like what you did.
Like
Steve did. We were so, our staff were so devoted to the project, and it kind of took over our lives for 2 or 3 years. And then this came about, you know.
Yeah. Do you remember the names of those two bosses who were?
Yeah, one was Jules Tileson. And he was my boss before I took this job, and he and I were kind of friends. I liked him a lot. He was a good boss. And the other one was David Doherty. What was his name?
Doris.
David Doris.
David
Doris.
And he
was kind of the right hand man of Jules. And after I went off and did the thing in Washington D.C. against Jules's edict, and I came back and I took Jules out to lunch to try to bury the hatchet, and he says, "You can't bury this hatchet," and we just became distant after that. So,
But so David's the one who said, "Go for it."
No, David is the one that said, "Don't let them go to Washington."
Oh. Dave worked for Jules.
Yeah, Dave worked for Jules.
Okay. And so who's the one who said, go for it?
My boss, and his name was the district manager at the time. Come on, Steve, your brain's better than mine.
No.
It wasn't Nolan Heath. He wasn't manager yet.
No.
That was later.
I can see his face. I can describe him.
But he retired shortly thereafter, and he just, you know, got out of the fray. And then Furman took it over.
Okay. Well, you know, it is one of my questions, and you've both kind of touched on it, is that how BLM dealt with this concept of having a trail and being a trail manager. They just thought of the trail as, well, this is a nuisance and we're just going to ignore it.
Well, I didn't think so initially. You know, I think everybody was behind it, and the funding was cool. I mean, they wanted part of the funding, and I had to go to a contact of mine so they wouldn't keep dipping into the pie. And, you know, they wanted the recognition of it all, but they didn't want to make a commitment on anything that would require staffing or funding.
In my view, management,
right? Yeah. Or implementation of the plan. And I think it's just, it's out there. I mean, you can't destroy the trail, and I think the volunteers have been doing as best they can by putting markers in and such and such. But, you know, I'm not even sure there's anybody from BLM that's even employed as a coordinator, you know.
No, there is. There has been. That's why I was going to say that eventually they did create a trail manager, trail administrator position. A guy named Kevin Keeler, he was the manager for, I don't know, like 20 years. He just recently retired. I think they've hired somebody new in that position. But I don't know. I can't remember exactly when they got that position going.
Hmm.
So they did at least do this one staff person, but they didn't do, you say, all the interpretive stuff and all the other things you guys recommended.
Right. And what, just a question, what has happened over the last 20 years?
Well, the advisory council, which then became, since it's become the Iditarod Historic Trail Alliance, and Judy Bittner has been incredibly involved in that, and Dan Seavey and Lee Pileski and a number of other people. So they've kind of, you know, they're sort of the liaison with BLM to push for the trail, and they've done a lot of public education things.
Oh, that's great.
Done some, you know, with BLM. Like BLM gets some money, and then they kind of give it to the Alliance to support local projects because BLM can't spend the money that way. So they've done some local shelter cabin rebuilds out of some of the villages, like out of McGrath. I think they did one. The old woman cabin, that got rebuilt quite a number of years ago. There's been, you know, trail marking, putting up signs. Somebody told me that, like, at the Unalakleet Airport, they have interpretive signage of some kind. In Seward, there's a big effort for, you know, Mile Zero, and they have statues and interpretive things there. But that was all instigated by the Seward Trailblazers.
Yeah,
right.
So that's the volunteers. The Seward has a Trailblazers. I think McGrath has one. Nome Kennel Club maybe kind of plays that role.
Well, I got to say, this is the way it was imagined to me, you know, that it would be run by volunteers and with direction from the BLM, but also to do some initial things that we thought needed to be done out of the BLM's budget rather than having to rely on volunteers. Now, the volunteers can do signing and trail maintenance and things like that, but I mean the construction of these cabins you talked about was and that probably came from BLM money that they turned over. That's great.
And a BLM helicopter probably, you know, dropping off the supplies at the site, and the you know, and then it does get mixed in with the race volunteers in terms of brushing out the trail and things like that. I think a lot of that is race volunteers.
Yeah, that's great.
It's a little confusing, but...
Well, that's great, just the coordination for the same objective.
Yeah. And then the Historic Trail Alliance has done a teacher education program called Iditarod Trail to Every Classroom that's based on the Appalachian Trail model. So using the trail as sort of a place-based learning opportunity to get people in the communities involved and doing projects and things.
Well, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. All that's wonderful.
Yeah. So,
so I have to give BLM a little more credit than I would think they had done. And so somebody coordinated all those efforts, and it must have been this guy that was hired by BLM. That's been 20 years. Yeah.
Yeah. But you're right. In your time period, that was, I was going to say, is, how did you, you know, deal with that in BLM where you may or may not have had the support?
Well, we had, I didn't feel like we had any support from the state office. I mean, they were just oppositional. And they, you know, when they'd come for a meeting across the table with all of us and two or three of those people, it wasn't productive, you know, it was, it just wasn't productive. It was, they had expectations that we didn't have, and we had expectations that they didn't have. So it wasn't a productive alliance.
And what was their role? I mean, did you,
They were staffed.
You worked.
They were staffed at the state director, and so all the funding requests for those, a lot of those projects, whether it was archaeology, wildlife, or recreation, all went through that office, and it got distributed to the different field offices. So they were essentially the project coordinators for all those individual things. Jules was the head of a staff of, you know, 8 or 10 specialists on each of those things. And David Doris was his right-hand guy, I think.
Because I was thinking if you were in the branch office, you would have done your own thing on the trail in the plan.
Well, the branch office, I mean, I had the responsibility when I first went out there because I wasn't going to take the job unless they included that. But once I got out there, I could see that the Iditarod project was going to be overwhelming and I couldn't do both. And so I pretty much just assumed that was the way it was going to be. And it was. The guy named Lou Waller is the one that had those responsibilities before I did. And they were taken away from him and given to me. And then once I said, I can't do that, they just gave it back to him. So
you reported to the state office?
No,
though.
I did my first job. I reported to the state office when I worked for Jules. I was the head of, I don't know if it's the head, but I was the head guy in BLM for outdoor recreation and wilderness.
But for the Iditarod Trail project, you reported to the state office or you reported to the branch?
I didn't report. The way it works is you have a district manager, and then a district manager has a, I think they call them a resource manager, and then under that they have branch managers. That was like third down, and the branches were based on specialties.
Oh, so you reported to the district manager.
Right. Who reported to the state director, just like Jules did.
Okay. Okay. Just trying to figure out the structure and why the state office had any role at all.
So they probably should have just stayed out of it, but they were, I mean, I can see why they would get involved if they see something in there that was egregious to them, such as putting funding requests or funding priorities in there that said, oh, we don't want to commit to anything, you know. And I think the state director probably bought into that too, after I was in D.C.
Mm-hmm. Well, and do you remember the process of, so you guys drafted this plan, and then it has to go through some review and approval process, right?
I was thinking about that. I'm sure it did. I mean, I don't think we just presented them the plan. I mean, this thing was an incremental thing. And we would draw in people that we needed to help us with those parts of the plan. And as it was going along, I can't remember exactly, but I'm sure we involved the state office on that. And they were either helpful or not. And I remember them being more of an impedance than they were of help. Because they wanted more of a hand in writing the plan, I think, even though it was delegated to us. So they were second-guessing what we were doing, and they were kind of interjecting their own views on it, which weren't compatible with what we were thinking in many cases.
Steve, do you have any comment on this?
Well, mostly that I'm glad I wasn't involved in that part.
That's why
that much.
Helicopter.
No, I mean it. That was kind of your bailiwick. I never really got it. In fact, this is enlightening to me in a lot of regards. I really didn't have much other than some of the public meetings, you know, where ideas were being formulated and drafting the draft plan. But I didn't know about all the inter-office turmoil that I knew Doris was an impedance to it, but...
Jules is the one that told me, do not go.
And
unfortunately, I didn't work all that out before I went, but I worked it out after they fired me.
I think it just boils down to what, you know, BLM claims they have an organic act that gives them 7 resource fields, you know, grazing, mining, forestry, cultural resources, recreation. There's several of them, but honestly, at that period of time, that mining and that was about it that they really paid any attention to, more or less. It's just,
yeah, that was when what was the guy's name of the Secretary of the Interior? James Watt was the Secretary,
yeah,
and he wanted everybody to work in oil and gas. They didn't care what the specialty was, you know.
Yeah. So
that's really the reason I retired in 83. I didn't get totally fired, but I was just disgusted with the way that was going for people that have resource values like Steve and I had, you know, conservation and conservation opportunities.
Yeah.
Sure. So yeah, Carrie, you said it. So after 81, you were transferred or whatever. Was that still in BLM or you went to work someplace else?
No, there was another provision of the ANSCA.
The Native Claims Settlement Act?
It was part of the 17th, like, maybe I'm getting my acts mixed up. What was the one? ANILCA, I guess. It was part
of ANILCA.
That ordered the Secretary of the Interior to come up with a management plan for a scenic highway between Paxson and McCarthy down the Denali, Richardson. Under Denali Highway. And so they needed this done within a couple years. Well, I worked on it, had a lot of meetings up and down, and it was resoundingly nobody wanted that. You know, I mean, none of the locals wanted that. And nobody wanted the Denali Highway paved, you know, nobody wanted it. First of all, I didn't know what a national scenic highway was. So I kind of traveled around a little and found out they had national scenic highways everywhere. And it goes everywhere from a visitor center to just signs on the road. So we had to determine what a scenic highway was. And then I went out and asked everybody, what do you think a scenic highway is? You know, because I didn't know. I had some ideas and examples from other scenic highways, but it was a resounding no. And I don't remember the letter that I wrote back to Congress, but it said no. And I don't know what, I can't remember what they did with me after that. I think that was probably the end of it, but I can't remember anything.
But then you said you retired from BLM in 83?
Right.
And then what did you go on to do other things?
Yeah, I went to, met a good friend of both of ours, where I got a job in Dillingham as a planner. Actually, the chief of planning, the officer of one, me. And that didn't last very long, like 11 months. And I can't remember what happened there, but it had something to do with the Native Corporation. They eliminated the funding of that position because they didn't want people telling them how to build their buildings and stuff. So they limited the funding for the position, which came from the Native Corporation, which Chogyon, which was a very powerful organization. And so I was without a job. But actually, when I quit BLM, I didn't have a job either. So I found this job, and I went out, my wife and I went out to Dillingham and did that for 11 months. And she was cutting hair in the sink. And then my Jim Anderson, a really good friend of Steve and mine, he had great skills as a carpenter, and I saw a shortage, and so, to make a long story short, we built houses for 3 years, and then I didn't have, that was over, and then I moved to Hawaii and bought a place down there, hoping to build something down there, but that didn't work out, and I came back to work for the only place I knew that I had any cabin. It wasn't my cabin, it was Steve's cabin, but I didn't mind trespassing in his cabin, you know. And so I went back to Eagle, where I didn't have a job. I said, well, just go there. And I, to my unbeknownst to me, that was the headquarters for Yukon Charlie Rivers National Preserve. I got hired as a GS5 in 1988, working as then one thing led to another. I stayed with the Park Service from that time until I retired in 2004.
Okay, great. Well, we've mentioned the Advisory Council and the Trail Alliance. Do you have any recollections of the Advisory Council and working with them?
Oh yeah, I did. Like we had like Floyd Chirac was on there that was very involved, and other people that were kind of figureheads. Dan Seavey, I think, was on there, wasn't he, Steve?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Joe.
And Joe Reddington. And so the people, I mean, they definitely provided guidance in terms of their thoughts of what they, because we were trying to figure out what we were doing. And they had some thoughts on the direction that we ought to move, just their thoughts. And it kind of jived with ours, you know, trying to figure out what this was to begin with and what we had to do to make it permanent, or at least winter permanent. So, and those, some of those people, like Rod Perry is the one that took me on the trail, you know, on the dog sled. So, and his wife, Patty Friend, was my right hand, another one of my right hand people on the project trail, Did Ride Project.
So you actually did get to go out on the ground on the trail. What was that like?
It was great. You know, not only that, we were trying to figure out how to pay for it. And so we just wrote a travel voucher and I got per diem when I was doing it. So I went from Kinnick Road to almost to McGrath, and I'd never been on a back of a sled in my life. And I spent a lot of time eating snow, you know, running into things I shouldn't have, but it was a wonderful adventure. And then somebody else, I think it was Lou Waller, that took it from there, and it eventually ended up with somebody getting all the way to Nome. But there were three of us. I took the initial part, and because I thought it was sounded like a boondoggle, I recruited people that I knew would support it because they were part of the occupying the sled after I was through with it. So it was kind of, it worked. It was very much fun. Yes, it was great.
Well, and so did it make a difference on your job and the plan, having been out on the ground?
Well, it did. Like, you know, all the stops were like Roan River Roadhouse. We're in disrepair, and it had been used a lot, you know, over the years as just part of the Iditarod Trail, not set necessarily the Racers Trail. And so places that you go to and you see how it had been used historically, and you wanted that to continue. You know, you wanted the trail designated and marked, and everybody knew what the trail was for the historic plan anyways. And like Steve said, you know, there's a bunch of trails out there that are all part of the prehistoric Iditarod Trail, the historic Iditarod Trail. But just trying to locate the main trail and the secondary trail, the signing part, that had been done. It was in the process of being done when I was there. I mean, people were following up on the racers, like I was following the racers, and I don't know how they ever passed me because I was going so fast, you know. But but somehow they passed me, and
you missed the turnoff for Nome, probably.
Yeah, right. I ended up in Dallas, you know, so. With a beer in my hand. So anyways, it was great, and it did bring a recognition that I wouldn't have had otherwise, of what it was like and the connection to the history. And I mean, you just feel the history when you're going down the trail. Many, many generations had been there before you. Mm-hmm. It's like going to a historic spot anywhere for me. It's a vicarious way I can almost place myself there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Steve, you spent a lot of time out on the ground on the trail or specific spots. I don't know if you ran it by dog team, though.
No, I didn't. I used the winged approach to it.
Yeah, he had his own helicopter.
Right. And so what was that like for you, going and going to those places?
Oh, wow. Well, I've always had an interest in the first generation architecture, if you will, not the white guy architecture and the settlement and, you know, just a sense of discovery. And when you go into some of these places like Old Woman and, you know, some of the other shelter cabins and relief cabins, where they're at and the sparseness of the country and the wilderness aspect of it is just, I won't say it's overwhelming, but it certainly has an impact on you. I guess I've always kind of been infatuated with that pioneering in these different areas, whether it's transportation or in pursuit of mining or some sort of subsistence lifestyle or whatever. And the people that you meet along the trail, and having retired to Arizona, not everybody has a story down here. Everybody in Alaska has a story, whether they were born there or they were crazy enough to travel there and make a life of it. That's part of the unique Alaskan experience, if you will, is the people.
Like Steve said, I spent over 20 years in Alaska, and Steve spent like 40 years in Alaska. And, you know, I lived in a little bit in Anchorage, 8 years, and then spent another 14 or 15 years in the bush. And that kind of set the stage of where, you know, what my life was going to be. And I ended up being with somebody that's absolutely the opposite of me. But it's reflects who I am as a person, I think, at this stage, you know, anyways.
Yeah. Yep. It was a lifetime experience that very few people ever get the chance to participate in, you know. It's totally unique.
And I think one of the highlights was when Steve actually let me on his helicopter, you know.
Well, I'll remind you, Carrie, you're the one that paid for it.
We went out to Iditarod, and I remember us going out there some of the buildings were laying down, you know.
Yeah.
But it showed off the engine and who you are in this little place that was a hub of
commercial activity, yeah.
Activity just not that long ago. You know,
yeah.
It's just the history of Alaska is just, as you know, Karen, it's just amazing. You know?
Yeah.
Right. Well, and yeah, as you say, you get there by helicopter and you stand there and think about, you know, originally, how did people get to this place on this trail?
Yeah.
They, you know, dog sled or horses or walked.
Right. And what I've read is that the Iditarod, the older historic trail, at certain times, you could walk on it without snowshoes. It was just hard, you know.
Snow was so well packed, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, before snow machines to pack it down.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and I'm thinking about, you mentioned the race, and the race does not 100% follow the historic trail route.
Correct.
Correct.
That's correct.
And why is that, that they don't line up?
Well, I think one thing is when the snow machines go out to pack the trail, they find routes that are not passable for some reason, you know, and either the creeks are not frozen or there's too much snow or something. No, the one when I was on that trail, that little short time, we had Rod was in front of me and I was following him, and we're coming up a rainy pass and a moose charged us and the person that was following me, the one in front of me, Susan Butcher, she had to shoot the moose, same moose probably, but I guess we didn't shoot it very good because it attacked us too.
I think that, you know, there is a stretch that they've never run, and that's the one that goes up through Dykeman to Dishkacket over to Aniak across the Anoka Flats. that's never been run. And I think we did. I think that's the primary route during the Iditarod, the period of the Iditarod. And then, you know, I think the race, probably because there are active communities along it in places. And
I think that's right. You know, like Ruby, they decided to go through Ruby when it wasn't part of the Iditarod, the original Iditarod, I don't think.
No, it was. I think there was a loop. It went from Porman north to Ruby to Galena down the river. And then the other one, they go to, was it Ophir? And they would go over and then they go up to Kel-Tag and then across the portage here. So there's some divergence from the historic route by the race.
Yeah, well, it makes sense that one section through Dishkaket and Aniak you're talking about versus going through Ruby and going to villages versus a stretch where there's nothing.
Yeah.
Right. And when we go to the public meetings, you know, when we were trying to draft the plan, you'd find that, like Steve said before, there was so much support for the Iditarod, and they would love for it to make their place a checkpoint, but it didn't always happen. But at least the race was diverted enough so you go to the villages, some of the villages that were still standing.
Opposed
to Dishkaket, you know.
Right. So, any other things about, you know, the cooperation with the advisory council or, you know, working with the Forest Service or the Park Service or the state, any other things that you guys did with the planning process?
Well, you know, all the members of the federal agencies that were involved, like the Forest Service guy, Clay, whatever his name was on his advisory committee, and the state was involved. I mean, they all represented the primary land owners or managers. And I can't remember, Steve, you probably remember, but we had coordination with the native corporations. They were all supportive. I don't think they had much say in what was written, but they were supportive, just like the villages were supportive. Yeah. And that's the reason, like Steve said, we diverted so some of those villages were included like they wanted to be.
Yeah, well, I think our declaration of the primary route really didn't have anything to do with active communities. It was just if they were part of that primary route during the Iditarod period, then they were in. The race basically took some variation from that to address the villages and the, you know, the local concerns and such. And I'm not certain, you know, at that period in time, were the native selections even completed yet by then?
Well, they were probably not, but we knew where they were going to be.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that we included, you know, I remember one guy that worked for the Federation, Alaska Federation of Natives, and he was a white guy, and I remember talking to him, and he just knew his villages would be very supportive. I remember getting involved.
Yeah.
But it was a win-win until it wasn't.
Well, and in the comprehensive plan, did you have to address the different land ownership issues and easements and things like that? Because as you say, native corporation land, there was private land, et cetera, et cetera.
We never, I don't remember us ever getting an easement. It was identified as one of the things to look at in the draft plan. But to this day, I don't think there's an easement because none was necessary. And it might have been because of historic use. What do they call that? Prescriptive use, you know, is if you can't block somebody using a route that's been used for 100 years. You know, I'm not sure how it worked.
I recall some years back that at one time, I don't know how I got involved with it, with the Park Service, the route we declared that followed the old military survey towards Rainy Pass through the state land selections, there was a conflict between the route and the parcels that they were wanting to turn over for public withdrawal, maybe in part of that homestead thing over there. And the state had taken exception with the historic route that had interfered with their superimposed survey for land disposal. And there was a proposal, the state said, we'll just move the trail so that it fits the edges of our, you know, arbitrary homestead parcels, if you will. And I think that that, it may have been through the SHPO that I heard something about that. I think that that was overturned. I mean, that request never went anywhere, I don't think. I think the route is still defined, although I've never seen anything in writing on it.
I don't remember it being an issue because it was so supported by all the people whose land we cross, even Forest Service, you know, and the new parks. And I don't remember the new parks being involved at all because I don't think they were created at that time. But yeah, it just wasn't an issue. I mean, you get a place like that, the Oregon Trail, and I can imagine the issues.
Yeah,
we didn't have those issues.
Yeah.
Well, there was a state easement office involved in doing some of that easement work. But it sounds like it wasn't part of your comprehensive plan.
Well, we addressed it in the plan, but it was one of the things that we were going to work on to see if they were needed. But it wasn't in the draft plan. It was addressed in the draft plan, but it wasn't identified as individually.
Yeah.
Well, and eventually there was a final plan, I think 1986, but it's only neither of you were involved in that in-between period to know how that all came about.
Yeah, right. I haven't even seen it. I know Terry was the head of it, and I'm sure he did a good job because he's a swell guy, you know.
Right. And Steve, you moved on as well, right?
Yeah.
He got a real...
What?
You got a real job that was full time, you know.
Carrie,
well, it's
never mind.
Go ahead.
I was going to make a smart aleck remark, but
you can do it later. I'm in charge of the smart aleck remark.
Are there things that you would like to see happen that on the trail that, you know, never happened?
Well, so much is done in this last 20 years that you talked about, Karen. I think that's a great start. You know, they did all that stuff with minimal funding. I think restoration and stabilization of some of the cabins, and you said two of them were already done. I think that's great. Identification of the history and having an actually separate Iditarod Trails office there in Anchorage, you know, as a visitor point of contact.
Yeah, and I wonder if they have an exhibit in the interpretive center there in Anchorage, in the federal. I mean, that would be a natural for
the federal public office.
Yeah, I don't know if there's any. I haven't been in there in years, so I can't tell.
I haven't either.
It'd be, that one small piece, but it seems to me that should be some sort of priority for them.
Yeah, I mean, you identified the Iditarod, like you said, Karen, as the race, but there's so much more to it that could be, in, you know, explored.
Mm-hmm. It's I think it's interesting. The race really puts a different perspective on the Iditarod experience. I mean, it's about getting through quickly, you know, the 10 days from Anchorage to Nome, you know, where it seems to me the experience, like the way Carrie did it or others, yeah, I guess some of that is this snow machines are still a race, but there's a skiing experience and, you know, and all of the patrol cabins and shelter cabins, and kind of a hiking linkage there if you could, but I guess if that demand was there, it would have occurred. You know what I'm saying?
So. I think a standalone place would be really nice in Anchorage, you know, that the visitors could, it'd be a point, a destination point for visitors that had known about the Iditarod because of the race of no other reason.
Yeah, it's a different side of the story.
Right. Well, as you say, yeah, doing it the old slow way gives you a different perspective and experience on the place.
Yeah, indeed.
And the fact that it part of it was, you know, is a winter trail and on the river, it does change how it could be used versus, you know, as you say, the Oregon Trail. It's kind of hard to hike the whole Iditarod Trail.
Yeah.
No,
it'd be difficult.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, living in Eagle, when I was there full time for a few years, and I do winter patrols, and I do it in snow machine, and even by snow machine, you had to do cutoffs, you know, because of open water and doing cross country on the old hiking. I mean, the old Trappist trails and stuff, and it was, I'm sure, the same way in that Iditarod, they'd have to make detours because of the environment.
Yeah.
Well, and there is an effort now in Alaska to develop the Alaska Long Trail, sort of, you know, the concept of like the Appalachian, you know, connecting all the trails so you could hike all the way through Alaska. And so how they might be hooking into Iditarod Trail, I don't know, but I can envision, you know, the Seward through, you know, Crow Pass and up that way.
Yeah,
through the Alaska Range, that would make sense.
Yep.
Well, I have a friend that from Norway that he and his girlfriend at the time landed in Cold Bay and walked all the way up to Prudhoe Bay, and they wrote books about it. So that's available if somebody comes up with this concept. Of course, it's written in Norwegian, but I have I have the books, you know.
Yeah, but so this sort of through.
I don't know what's in them, but I've got the books.
Well, sort of this through trail, long distance hiking, you know, it's always been the Appalachian Trail and Pacific Crest Trail and things, but I think it's becoming more popular. So it's now being talked about in Alaska.
There was an article on it the other day, I think. I read an online article.
I can sort of imagine the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Sort of we'll start with Carrie. What were some of the biggest challenges or frustrations? Because we've talked about the successes of the plan, but of working on this project.
Well, it wasn't public support. It was just, it was working with the, having trouble with the agency. And it was really the big, it wasn't, I pick on these two guys from the state office because they're easy to pick on because they were leading the fray. But this just wasn't a job that BLM had any experience in, didn't know what to do. Other agencies did, but not BLM. And just dealing with BLM to try to do this initial effort on a national historic trail was a little bewildering, and I think we came together as a group very well, but our main opposition seemed to be the repercussions that these people, the state office, felt would happen if we requested everything that we requested. Or we didn't request it, we just said this is what needed to be done to as part of this management scheme that we were coming up with.
And Steve, what about you? Any challenges or frustrations about the job or involvement with the trail?
Don't talk about your supervisor.
Yeah, working for Carrie, I don't know.
Yeah, spend more time vetting your supervisors. Huh? No. No. I mean, it was a good experience. It was a discovery experience for not only the team, but for the agency itself. And it was, you know, given the political climate of that time, I guess BLM made sense, but they took a will-do comprehensive plan and turned it into a maybe we'll do it comprehensive plan. And the maybe we'll do it part of it kind of succeeded, I think, unfortunately.
Yeah.
How did that feel, having put all that work and passion into something to then have it, you know, put on a shelf?
Well, it was a slap in the face to me because you know, I had this team of specialists that poured their heart and soul into it, doing what we thought was the right thing and getting direction from this congressionally appointed advisory committee, you know, and getting their support, getting everybody's support except the agency that we work for. And I,
Steve?
I think I agree with what Carrie just said, but that's 45 years in the past, and we all know how much Alaska has changed on many fronts, you know, over that period of time. And the fact is that the race is still popular. It has its annual challenges, of course, but it has a legacy, and you know, that's, you don't see that on the Oregon Trail. You don't see it on the Santa Fe Trail. You don't see a, you know, an annual trek, if you will, if that's the right term. Mm-hmm. Whereas the race does. So it still is there in the public consciousness and part of the Alaskan consciousness. So I'd still say that active management on the Iditarod, it's a white hat effort for BLM if they had smart enough to embrace it, you know.
Mm-hmm. And what about for each of you personally, having been involved in the planning process, what that's meant for you?
Well, go ahead, Steve.
Go ahead.
Well, my MBA was in planning, and so I was kind of knew the concept of the planning process and what had to be done for any plan, you know, and I'd been involved at my state office and doing several river management plans and wilderness management plans. So I'd done a lot of planning in my other job. And then when I got kicked out of BLM, I went to work as a planner in the village of Dillingham, you know. So but planning to me is, as I look back in my career, is a very unrewarding job, because you get so many jobs that they set on the shelf and nothing ever happens, you know. I worked at Katmai National Park and the Brooks Camp there. It's been planned for probably 40 years on moving the place, and nothing ever happens, you know. And I worked on that plan some, because I was in the administration over there. And but when I came back to work for the Park Service after doing other things, I really enjoyed it. I started the GS5 seasonal. No responsibility, somebody to go dig a hole, and I go dig a hole and finally found something I was good at, you know. and I worked as a 5 and a 6 and a 7, and then I got into, you know, supervising people, and it was a great career for me, you know. And I'm glad I ended that way without any bad taste in my mouth, you know. It was a great final career for me. Mm-hmm.
Steve, what about you?
What was the question again?
About sort of what it's meant to you personally to have worked on the Iditarod Trail Comprehensive Management.
First of all, it gave a broader view of the geography of Alaska and the communities and the people along the trail. The idea of being the first in on some of this, in terms of inventory and just discovery of it, has been a rewarding something very rewarding in the life that we spend in Alaska. And it's contributed, I think, to some of the other things that I've gone on to do with the Park Service. So it was, we talked about some of the negative, but overall it was a very, very positive experience.
Same with me, you know. Yeah. The bad part that ended up was just a blip compared to the whole experience, you know.
Good point. Yep.
Yeah. Well, and you both, it was sort of early on in your careers. You were on the younger side probably and just starting out.
Well, don't you think that people that come to Alaska, at least when we first came there, young people advanced very quickly in decision-making and management. And I don't know if that's because of the shortage of young people or just the state that was so robust, you know, that the opportunities were there maybe a lot of times long before you were prepared to do it, you know, sink or swim. So it was good.
One thing I've noticed, especially in Alaska, is that you get the young people, like, you know, the staff that I had working with me, and they're gung-ho. And then the people that finally get to the top are so careful not to annoy anybody or not to make anybody mad. When we didn't care if we were going to make people mad, we would just had a project that was pretty well spelled out, and we didn't have to be so cautious. And I think that was good for me anyway. And I think it was good for everybody to be so focused on a project they could put pretty much everything else aside. I mean, maybe that's a little cutting off my nose despite my face because of the way it turned out. But the same token, it was like Steve said, a bunch of young, gung-ho people, guys and gals, you know.
Yes.
It was a great organization. It was a great experience.
Young people are naive.
Yeah, exactly.
Managerially naive.
Well, yeah, it sounds like everybody on your team was very passionate and got very excited about the history of the trail and documenting it and all that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, Steve, did you do any supervising? Well, you mentioned that intern, but when you were out doing this field work and historic research, was it just you or there were other people?
It's usually just me. I had that summer intern, Randy Scott. Was it Skyrick? That's not right. I said that earlier. His first name was Randy Copeland. Randy Copeland.
Oh, I remember him.
Yeah. But that was pretty much it. My role was to map and document, and that's what I did. I was fortunate in that I was able to stay out of most of the stew that Carrie was in with the politics of the situation, you know.
So. Yeah, it was a problem.
If you have any other things you want to talk about, share your memories, experiences that I haven't talked about or I skipped over in our list of questions.
Well, my brain hurts from all the questions you've asked.
Well, I think the bottom line is we thought it was a wonderful project. I think the product we turned out was wonderful. We didn't implement a lot of stuff that we wanted to implement, but by the total of all this is that it was very rewarding, and I'm glad I did it. And no matter how it turned out, it was a great experience for me. And I, talking for the rest of the staff, I bet if you talk to people aside from Steve, they feel the same way.
I agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, it's been 2 hours, so I figure we've probably tapped your brains.
That doesn't take much.
Probably thing. Tired.
I'm going to have to go lay down now.
Well, hopefully it's brought back some good memories.
Great. It definitely has.
And I said, I looked over the plan this morning and I showed it to Sue, my partner, and she was like, this is a magnificent thing that you guys put together. I mean, all the graphics in it, the charts and all the supplements, and it was a good product. It turned out like we thought it was going to turn it in terms of,
well, that's good.
In terms of the plan anyways.
Yeah. Well, I have heard, I think that they are maybe doing a new plan.
Really?
That they revived, because I've asked about, well, that was, you know, 1981.
Yeah.
And it's 2025. It's kind of, shouldn't you have a new management plan? And so I think they might be in the process of doing that.
Well, good. If it wasn't for you saying something, they would probably be sitting on their thumbs now, you know.
No, I don't think I have anything to do with it.
Oh, Karen, it was nice to talk to you.
It was great.
Yeah, well, thank you guys, and thank you, Carrie, for pulling Steve into this. It's great to hear their different experiences.
Absolutely, and Please keep us posted, both of us, on what's going on with your project, and if you see any little revelations that we wouldn't know about, like a new plan coming together. It'd just be interesting to try to keep up with that.
You know, okay. You know, this trail thing is interesting because Kerry lives, what, about 2 miles from the Santa Fe Trail?
Yeah.
And one of the guys I worked with in Alaska wrote the plan for the Santa Fe Trail, the most recent update. And then Bill Brown, who we've known for, who's gone now, but right. He did the initial Santa Fe Trail plan in the 50s, 60s, somewhere back there. So anyway, small world.
And my great-great-great-grandfather delivered merchandise on the Santa Fe Trail.
They did.
From St. Louis, yeah.
Yeah. Huh.
Interesting. Anyway. Yep. Well, all trails lead to Santa Fe.
Well, it's a good place. They tried to go through Prescott, but there was too much snow, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. They got lost.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Karen.
All right. Thank you. Have a good rest of your day.
Yeah. Same to you.
It was fun to meet you guys. Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.